Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
To the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stacy Okowski.
Theme today on Monday, June 6th. No, Monday, June 5th. we might have two Mondays this week. You never know. Our theme today is military memories or serving far from home. And I understand there's going to be a bit about mothers in there too, from both of us. So we'll see how that works out. How was your weekend, Stosh?
So it was a lovely weekend, nice and kind of relaxing. And it was very nice.
Good.
I got to sit out on the patio behind the house quite a bit and started a new book, which I will finish maybe tonight.
Good for you.
Yeah. I started reading a book by Sandra Brown a couple of weeks ago, and I went through it while we were at the beach. And I think at the time, Terry was kind of amazed at how I just kept reading, you know, and went through the book. And this lady writes like crime novels, thrillers. She has a unique style. It just keeps you. Once you finish a chapter, you want to go on and on because things keep happening. It's not like boring, long, you know, with crazy details and stuff. It just stuff keeps happening. The characters keep doing things. So,
what's the title?
This one's called Blind Tiger, which is
right. I will look it up.
Yeah, and the other one was called Switching, about twins, which was fascinating. So, and she's written, I think she's written about 40 books.
Wow. Okay, something to look forward to.
There you go.
I did want to thank Andy Offit Irwin for opening our show with his composition, Tarry Here. And this is my opportunity to say that Andy Offit Irwin will be with us in Hagerstown on Monday, June 26th at Stories in the Round at the Unitarian Universalist Church, 13245 Searfoss Pike, just west of the city limits. And
do you think we might get Andy on air?
Maybe. We'll see.
Well, that would be nice.
Maybe not that evening. Well, maybe not that morning because he's on his own for the, you know, he needs some downtime, but we'll see. Maybe we could pre-record or something.
Yeah, that would be nice.
And if you want tickets, you can contact me, Fanny Crawford, at Fanitsky, F as in Fanny, A-N-I-T-S-K-Y, at hotmail.com, or 301-730-1638. And the registrations, the requests for seats are pouring in, so people need to get their ticket. Probably you would be better getting your tickets in advance and then depending on there being space, because we're not as big a venue as we used to be. I think we can only hold about 50 people, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah. So hope to see all of our listeners there. I just saw you throw Terry a kiss. You should throw her.
I did, because she is going to her yoga room.
That's good.
Yeah.
So tell us about Speak.
Okay. Excuse me. Speak is roaring through the season. And in June, a week from tomorrow, June 13th, and then the next day, June 14th, Reverend Robert Jones will be here. And we'll be, well, he'll be in Shepherdstown. He won't be here in Martinsburg, but he is an inspirational storyteller, singer, instrumentalist, and visual artist celebrating the history of American roots music. His repertoire includes many styles of traditional African-American folk, including spirituals, gospel, and country blues guitar. He's performed throughout the United States and Canada and Europe. He's also the co-founder of a nonprofit organization called Common Chords, a program that seeks to build bridges between communities using music, storytelling, and art. And he'll be here June 13th and 14th at the Shepherdstown Opera House.
Oh, we'll be in the Opera House this time.
Yes, and we can you can get all the details about that performance and others coming up at speakstoryseries.com. And the following month in July 11th and 12th will be Adam Booth. Everybody loves Adam Booth, and he's always one of the best draws for the Speak Story series.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. He's going to be at Stories in the Round, too, towards the end of the season.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's nice.
So on our theme of military memories or serving far from home, and mothers. Would you like to go first, Nash?
All right, and I am desperately interested in your story.
Okay, well, desperately is a good word. We'll see how this goes. All right, so this is my mother, Miriam Crawford, talking. And if you would take a few notes for me, Stash, the parts that jump out at you. This is my first time telling this story. There are little bits of other stories I've told that might show up in this one as I'm rambling about. But I don't tell that many stories in my mother's voice. So
okay.
This is an experiment. Okay. Mom? All right, I'm here. And I'm on the radio, right? Fanny says you're talking about military memories, serving far from home. Now, neither one of these would be a topic anyone with their feet on the ground would ask me to contribute on. But I am a librarian. Well, before I retire. Oh, no, right here at Stapley Retirement Home, I volunteer as a librarian. So never mind. Librarians know a little bit about everything. So I will just tell you my version of that. Let me start here. Oh, my mother, Rose, her family was from England. The men were Jewish Masons. And Mama was third generation in this country. But we had family, Hochheisers and Wexners on my father's side, still in Austria and Poland. So that was something we talked about regularly. Now, I was born in 1916, not old enough to remember World War I. But when I was a teenager in the 1930s, we were hearing about the persecution and sometimes prosecution of Jews in Europe and then the war. Now, my mother's family was not Orthodox. We kept the Jewish holidays, but my father's family was much more religious. And so hearing about the suffering of Jews and many, many other people in Europe, it made an impression on me. And when people hear that I joined the WACS, the Women's Army Corps. They ask why. Well, there were many, many women who joined up, not just me. But I guess not everyone knows that these days, that there were so many women who were serving in World War II. I had a boyfriend at the time. And he kept saying we should both join the service because then we could serve together. We'd both be fighting the Nazis. Well, I was not that naive. I knew we would not be serving together, but it did get me thinking more seriously. And I ended up joining. My sister, Irene, she joined up too. She wasn't going to let me get away with anything, you know, go off on my own and be a big star in the army. She joined the Navy, though. She had to be a little bit different. Irene and I were very close growing up. We were only 18 months apart in age, so we did everything together. I remember washing dishes together, walking home from school together every day, singing Russ Colombo ballads, Borch songs. You probably don't know who that is. He was a crooner from Brooklyn. We were Brooklyn girls. Like many other singers from Brooklyn, Barbara Streisand, Bing Crosby, Rudy Valley. But in those days, it was Russ Colombo who was the big star. We didn't have many records in our house, but we had Russ Colombo. Irene and I were big fans. Brooklyn was an interesting place to live, of course. And in the 30s, there were so many new things happening. Fiorella LaGuardia was elected mayor in 1934. And then the subway unification changed the borough so much. That was the largest railroad merger in US history, 1939. The IRT, that was the Interborough Rapid Transit. Funny to me, it never felt rapid, but it was, we used it all the time. The Brooklyn Manhattan Transit, the BMT and the ISS, what was that? That was the independent subway system. Later, it had a different name later. Who knows what that stands for? I'm a librarian. I said, you know, I'm supposed to know these things, alphabet soup. These three railroads merged. Now, back in the 40s, 8 million riders a day, that was a really big deal. Maybe not anymore that many. But when I was growing up, the average New Yorker had 300 subway trips a year, each person. So it was a really big deal when those three systems came together. And it was important to me because I was going to Brooklyn College. These days, too many cars. New York City never figured that out. There were horses when I was a kid. Clumps of horse poop everywhere. The horses should not be in the city. What a mess. And now there's just too many automobiles on those narrow streets. I think Fanny told you I'm going to ramble because there's so many things I could talk about. Well, I'm a city girl. I was born and raised in the city, Queens and Brooklyn, but I always had a soft spot for the woods and the green open spaces. I was a campfire girl. I went camping in tents with groups of girls for days at a time. Mama and Dad, I talked them into letting me go to these things. And I was hooked from the start. That was the beginning. The campfire girls organized hikes and bicycle adventures all year round. And that's how I learned to cope with bad weather and how to dress in layers to stay warm, how to pitch a tent, how to pack for and carry enough food for days at a time. But it was the freedom I felt working out of doors, the challenge of solving problems together, learning how to function in all kinds of weather and terrain, solving challenges that attracted me to that kind of activity. And I should say, one reason I fell in love with Fanny's father, with Bill, he took me camping. He had a big tent, a big army-sized tent. Slept four of us, Bill, me, and our children, and all our gear. 20 years we had that tent. Well, after high school, I applied for Roosevelt's Work Projects Administration stipend so I could afford Brooklyn College. There's no cost for the school itself, but I still needed car fare to get there and a little bit more so I could pack a bologna sandwich for lunch. Then Pearl Harbor happened, and I joined the WACS. I thought I can be somebody who could help. I could, you know, I could type. I knew a lot about research. I read the newspapers every day, so I knew what was happening in the world, and I wanted to help. And I was stationed in Conway, Arkansas for training, and then I served at Camp Shelby in Mississippi. The summertime in the South was a big shock to my system. Nothing, I had never experienced that kind of weather. But I adjusted slowly and I did adapt. Maybe worse was the shock of living under Jim Crow laws. There were segregated areas even in New York City. Build, private clubs, things like that. But living in the South was different. Everything was segregated. By contrast, the weather was relatively benign. The best part of those years for me were the friends I made there, few of whom are still good friends. We mostly phone or send letters at this point. We're scattered all over 5 or 6 states and abroad. You know, when I was there in Mississippi, my friends would organize something to have fun on the holidays, very loosely based on Christmas or around Hanukkah, or both. We were very ecumenical as WACS, at least my crowd was. We'd sing a few Christian carols and we'd spin the dreidel at the same party and drink a little wine if we could get it. Sometimes it was easier there to get whiskey, first in Arkansas and then at Shelby in Mississippi. This was the early 40s, of course. I do miss those friends very much. Wish I could see them more often. But I wanted to tell you, my brother, Hank, was in Alaska during that time as a radio operator. And he somehow got leave to come all the way to Mississippi to see me. He took a lot of pictures. I think that's why he wanted to come, was to get pictures of his sisters, the WACS and the WAVE. But it was really good to see him, especially during the war, and to know that he was a little bit safer than a lot of guys were. But I was just Private Wexner from Ocean Avenue in Brooklyn, Prospect Park South. Those were important days for me. And when I hear everybody's war stories now, it was not like that for me. It was an office job for me. We were doing Rorschach tests for the GIs returning home. And I was never very impressed with Sigmund Freud, but Rorschach tests, I could kind of understand how they might be helpful. And that's what I did. I was in the office most of the day, and I would get to meet these boys, these men who were coming back from Europe and the Pacific, and some of them were not in good shape. And I like to think that maybe those Rorschach tests helped the doctors and the therapists that they were working with. Anyway, that's my story for now. Fanny says I need to work on those stories. Oh, I know what she wanted me to tell you about. She said when she took me to the VFW in Hagerstown, Maryland, my granddaughter, Fanny's daughter, was working there. I think she was in the kitchen. And when I came to visit them, this was not too long ago, they took me there for dinner. And it was a decent dinner, but the staff there made such a big fuss over me because I was a vet. And I thought, well, that was the first time I'd ever been to an organization like that, where everybody thinks you're the cat's pajamas because you were in the service. And I enjoyed that. That was fun. All right. That's enough for me today.
Wow. That was great. And I guess you want to know a time?
Sure.
Okay, so here's 30 seconds and 13 minutes and 30 seconds.
All right. Now, if I can just wrestle that into an actual story, that would be a fine time.
Well, I found it fascinating. In fact, I liked I liked you as your mother.
Oh, thank you.
I like you as you too, but I liked you as your mother. In fact, I thought that could be a powerful personal presentation. Have you ever done your mother before?
Yes. I have like three different stories that I tell her, but they're relatively brief. I've never done a whole hour or anything like that. But
yeah, I think if you would do more details about being in the military, and how old she was, there were a couple of things that confused. Well, one thing confused me. Who is Rose?
My grandmother, Miriam's mother.
Oh, okay. Because you mentioned grandmother and Rose and everything, and I didn't hear Miriam's name, and I was thinking, did Miriam have another name? I wasn't real sure. So it was it just.
You're and, right. And I did not do that.
Right, and all right. So, but I think more. If you told that story with more details about how she dressed, was she in uniform during
that? Yep, she was. I have pictures of her that Uncle Hank took in her dress uniform.
Right.
And then there are a lot of candids of her at Camp Shelby with friends, right, where she's in fatigues.
Well, I think details like that would be wonderful. I mean, I remember as a kid, as a young man, when I went into the service, and then when I was home on leave once, and I found out that my Aunt Martha was a WAC, and then I got to see pictures of her in uniform and hear some stories from her about how she met Uncle George, because she met him in the military. And it was really fascinating, you know. And as a kid growing up, I don't think I ever thought of a woman in uniform. Because, you know, boys, we played all kind of crazy war games, which is embarrassing now to think of, you know, we pretended we were fighting against the enemies of the good people and all that stuff. And when I think of it now, it's like, wow, we said some terrible things that we would never say today, you know. And I don't mean like curse words and everything, and just nasty things about Nazis and about Japs and stuff like that. And there was a time when, in fact, I think what I just said, that derogatory term for Japanese people, is first time I've said that in many years. But that was common when I was a kid. That was a very strong derogatory word, you know. And there were a lot of that going on when I was a kid. DP, do you know what a DP is?
Dispossessed person.
Yeah, but in my neighborhood in Baltimore, you know what a DP was? A dumb no. Polack.
Oh, yeah.
And it was seriously used that way. You know, I mean, the first time I had somebody say that to me was at a store, went down on Broadway in Baltimore, and I mentioned it to my father. This guy, I said, this man behind the counter called me a DP. And he said, he didn't tell you what it meant, did he? I said, no, I wonder what the heck is a DP? I was a kid. I was only 7 or 8 years old. And my dad explained that that was a common euphemism in their area for dumb Polack. And most of the kids in that, I knew either Polish, German, or Italian people. They were the only ones that I ever knew when I was growing up in the 40s and early 50s. And I always hated that expression. And then as I got older, I found out that it meant displaced person, or, you know, and I thought, well, that's not so bad. At least it doesn't sound derogatory to me. Anyway, but I like that about your mom very much. The topic that you were talking about, and you mentioned, inspired me because there were lots of people who served in the wars, and lots of times people who couldn't serve for one reason or another, or, you know, because of age or something. But how old was your mother when she went into the WACS?
She went in 41. No. Keep talking. I'm going to look that
okay.
up.
Okay. Right. All right. So here. So I wanted to talk about serving, you know,
42.
Helping people.
42. She was 26.
She was 26 years old. Oh, yeah. Okay. And, you know, I'm not sure what the rules were at that time. But I doubt that someone that was almost 40 years old would never be able to, especially a lady, probably wouldn't be able to volunteer then, for all kinds of reasons. And same way with men. I know my dad, when I was a kid, I didn't understand about my dad not being in the military. Because his brothers were, he was the oldest son in the family. He was the kind of head of the family after his dad died. But he was not, he had registered for the draft and everything, but he was not eligible for the draft because of various things. When I was a kid, I didn't understand that. I used to kind of not mention my dad about being in the military. Until once at my best friend's house growing up, we found some stuff in the attic about his father being in the military, and there was some medals and some patches and stuff. And when we asked his dad about that in the evening, and you know, because we weren't doing anything wrong, we just found this stuff in the attic and watched and talked about that. And I said, I wish I had known. I wish my dad had been in the service. And he said, what's the matter with you? What do you mean? I said, well, my dad didn't serve in the Second World War. He said, no, because your dad's a few years older than I am, quite a few. And he was in the Coast Guard in the 20s. So, and he said, you should ask your father to see some pictures of him, because I have seen a couple pictures of him on the Coast Guard cutter. In fact, I didn't even know the name of the boat. It was the USS Apache. It was a Coast Guard cutter that he served on. So that, because my dad never talked about his service time, that took a big cloud away from me, because I had thought my dad didn't go into service, and I wondered why, because one of his brothers died in a war, and his other two other brothers who were closer to him in age served and everything. Anyway, when I did ask my dad about his service, he talked a little bit about it, but not much. Here's another thing. One of the things that I really, really, really appreciated when I was in the Army. In 1959, I joined the Army. In 1960, after spending the training in South Carolina and then being sent to Texas for school to become a radar operator. And the following summer, in 1960, I was given orders to, I got a leave to go home before shipping out to Germany. And so in 1960, I was sent out to Germany. Well, one of the nice things that my mother could do for someone that was far away from home, and she was not the only one by thousands, I'm sure. One of the things that I learned about in the Army firsthand, and also because of seeing it secondarily, was care packages. The first time I heard about a care package, it wasn't in basic training, but it was in Texas, where somebody got a package from home and they called it a care package, but it really wasn't like anything they needed for care. It was crackers or some kind of goodies, you know, chocolates and stuff like that. And then when I was in Germany, one of the best surprises ever, I was only there about maybe 4 weeks, and I got a package from my mother. My mother sent me some Polish sausage that she had made through the mail, and I'm not sure how you could do that in those days, but I guess that wasn't a big deal anyway. But I remember, and it was a lot of Polish sausage. And so I took it to we had a lot of duty in the field. We had a barracks that we'd stayed in, but then we went to the field because we were protecting our Nike missiles were set up to protect a air base and hospital close by. So we were on top of a small mountain with our radar, and then the missiles were down in the valley. Anyway, when we were on duty out in the field, there was a kitchen there, and we were served breakfast and lunch and dinner, and we could get coffee at night, stuff like that. But I took that box of sausages to the field, and I asked the cook if he could do something with it, and we had three meals out of that sausage for over a period of 2 days, and boy, it was wonderful, and everybody really enjoyed it, because anything from home cooked food and stuff was a big deal. Not that our food that we got was bad or anything, but it was nice to have stuff, you know, from your mother's kitchen and that. And I always thought that was great. And after the Army, when I was in college, one of my good friends, Joseph Catrone, who played soccer with us, and Joe was a short guy. He and I got along real well because I was one of the smaller guys in my class. And his parents are also very short people. they weren't like, you know, I don't want like the word midgets or dwarves or anything like that. They were just short people. They were like, his mother was 4 foot something and his father like 4 foot 10. His father, I think, was 5 foot even. And Joe was short also, but his mother surprised him on the very first month of college with a great box of stuff. And when he told me about it, I said, "Ah, care packages. We used to get that in the Army." And it was wonderful. She sent him a box. About every 3 or 4 weeks, he would get a box of some soup packages, crackers, cheese, chocolate, and all kind of goodies, mints and stuff like that. And Joe was a really great guy. He would share with us. He would, you know, share with his friends who were staying. And I was mostly friends with guys studying in sciences, because my major was in chemistry. And it was really nice. And I introduced the name care packages to the guys in the dorm, because they thought that was funny to say care packages, but I told them that's what we called it in the Army. And it was really neat. And it was a way of making people far away from home, because Joe's parents lived up in New England. So he was away from home for the first time. And it was a very neat thing. So your story, well, your mother serving and doing things for the in the military and making a difference reminded me about mothers who didn't serve in the military, but who supported the military by doing things, and some of them who helped out in other ways with the USO things and that. And then when I was in college also, a nice thing about being a veteran was, without me even asking anybody, my first couple of days in school, I received a invitation from the VFW and the American Legion and the Knights of Columbus. All three of those organizations had a building in the small town near my college. And I was given a membership to each one of those places. Without asking anybody or anything, I received a card from each one of those with my name and mentioned my rank. And that I wasn't sure how they found that out, but it seemed like there was something. And I was the oldest member of my college class because of going in the military before college. And it was kind of neat. And it was a big deal, because I could go into town. I was old enough. I was 21 when I started college. And I could go into town with my soccer coach, who was only 8 years older than I was. And I could take him to the VFW or the American Legion as my guest, and we could have a beer. And, you know, and that was kind of neat. You know, it was nice that there was some kind of respect attached to the fact that I was a vet. I was never in any combat or anything like that, but I was a vet. I did serve 3 years in active duty. And I think it was something that I did impulsively as a 17-year-old when I joined. However, over the years, it turned out to be a great benefit to me. The Army actually helped pay, because of my military service, the Army helped me go through to get my master's degree for the GI Bill. And that was wonderful, because they gave me a monthly stipend, and I was able to get my master's degree. I spent 2 years studying for that, going to night school and school during the summertime. And they gave me a stipend, which paid for the courses, and also gave me, had some extra money each month, which was really a nice thing. And especially because the original GI Bill had run out, and the new GI Bill was passed. It was actually passed in the same month I graduated from college. And so, same month, that I graduated from college. And I thought maybe retroactively they would pay for my college, which my dad and I had paid for. But that was no, I didn't qualify because it was passed that, you know, at the end of my college thing. However, the nice person in the office that I contacted said, there's going to be a new GI Bill passed soon. And when it is, if you want to go into graduate school or something, be sure to apply. And I did. And it was great. I was able, you know, I didn't have to pay anything to get my master's degree. And that was wonderful. So being in the military has lots of benefits. And especially if you're lucky enough not to have to be in war.
Absolutely.
Yes. So.
Great story, Stosh. Thank you. Yeah. I did not time you, unfortunately.
I'm completely oblivious to time.
Do you give me a time check right now?
Right now, we've been on the air for 41 minutes.
Okay. Good to know.
Yeah. So, your turn at bat.
Okay. Well, I guess one of the things I wanted to talk about was, this is not on topic so far, at least I have not yet made that link in my brain, but the stories in the round session that we had on the 22nd, what was very gratifying from my perspective. I thought the audience was very excited about the tellers who came. The tellers were all happy and they sold a whole bunch of books, the anthology, the new Rio Circle of Maryland storybook. That's the first ever anthology of Maryland storytellers, so far as I know, anyway. And they're continuing to do events to get that book out. But it was fun for me to be there. The drummer Hannibal L was, I thought, wonderful. And
that was exciting.
Yeah, he added a whole other dimension to the process. But in thinking, I guess, in thinking about stories in the round, I just sent a text or an email to Mark Brew of the Antietam Storyteller Guild. The tellers who came last month on the 22nd of May were from the brand new Black Storytellers of Western Maryland group. But that the success of that session and the audience enthusiasm for having a series of tellers from the same group with a particular perspective gave me the idea to ask Mark if he would be interested in putting on a liars contest for us later in the season. So I just sent him that question, and I'm going to call him later today and pursue that with him. So that's on my mind, on my agenda.
Yeah, that sounds good.
I think there's enough tellers who would be willing to tell under the auspices of the Antietam Guild that we could get a good group together. I would be willing to be part of that group since I'm a member, but I don't even think I would need to do that. I think there's enough other tellers who would step up.
Oh,
so I'm hoping to talk to Mark later today.
Good. I mean, I'm hoping that goes well.
Yeah, me great. Too.
Yeah. Yeah, we have some good storytellers in that group.
We do. Yeah, absolutely.
Three of the women I can think of are excellent right off the bat.
Mm.
You and Laura first, and
Renee Emanuel.
Renee Emanuel, just wonderful. So that'd be great. That would be just wonderful. And a liar's contest.
That would, I think that would be pretty exciting. Well, I know the you and Mark have worked together to do liar's contests at Vendors in Sharpsburg. Right. So I thought that was right up his alley, and he would might be interested in that.
Well, it'd be good. I'm glad. And, you know, this weekend, just in looking at stuff on the internet, just perusing things, I came across a thing for like a flyer that was advertising storytelling, and it was BSD. And I thought, wow, I wonder. And then I looked at the rest of the flyer, read down to the bottom, Black Storytellers of Detroit.
All right.
It was, you know, an event coming up sometime. I believe it was in later in June, and by the Black Storytellers of Detroit, which is, you know, I thought, wow, that's neat. We just found a new group in Hagerstown, you know?
Yeah. I think there are 15 affiliates of the National Association of Black Storytellers.
Right. Across the country. Sorry. I still have a hard time with not a hard time. This is just some in my development over my 80 some years. When I was a young person, calling someone a Black person was really frowned on after a while. There was a period of time when I was real little, the term Black person was very common. You know, early 40s to early 50s and this. And then it seemed like when I got near in my teen years, there was a real, I don't know what it was, but it was like if you used the word Black in describing someone, it was really frowned upon that was being bad and not respectful. And then as I got older, now there's, you know, everybody in the world is Black something, you know. I mean, all the entertainers, you know, and there's not that negative connotation to it anymore. In fact, there's even things on TV. There's like the Black Network, you know, and stuff like that. And I'm not as interested that much in sociology and things like that. But I would love to find a good book or a good even a scholarly approach to explaining the impact of those kind of names, because you know, I never understood the dual, I don't know if it's a dual standard or not, but you know, Black comedians especially are incredibly, a lot of them are incredibly loose with derogatory terms about their fellow Black friends, neighbors and stuff. And they use slang words that I would never say anytime. I don't use.
Well, not just Black people, comedians.
Oh, no.
Comedians use a lot of bad language talking about everybody.
I know. Yeah. You know, and it's just like, I have a hard time, you know. It's like, I don't tell Polish jokes. I don't think they're, you know, all that funny and everything. And one of the reasons that I dislike them is I remember coming across a book when I was a kid, maybe 14, 15 years old. A friend of mine showed me a book that belonged to his father, and it was about Italians, and it was full of jokes about people that were Italians And it was the exact same bunch of jokes that I had heard about people who were Polish.
Sure.
And he explained to me that there was a book just like that about people who were German. And, you know, and that was, I guess I shouldn't have been a big surprise that there were.
And people buy them.
Yes.
Do you think there's somebody who has a whole set, who has the whole set? Huh? Think there are people who have the whole set.
I wouldn't doubt it, but it was, you know, and that just was so shocking to me in a way. And then also it was sort of liberating in a way in mind to think, oh, it's not only Polish kids who get picked on. It's every all kind of kids get picked on, or all kind of people get picked on by their neighbors, you know. And it was, I think it was the first time I really realized, I don't know, I was pretty young, but first time I really understood that the people on the other side of the fence who are different than you, whatever, for whatever reason, in height, in width, in the way they look, the way they speak, they're going to be the butt of the jokes. And when they're having their gatherings, you're going to be the butt of the jokes, because it seems like that's a kind of a natural thing with human beings, that picking on the other, you know, if that person's not one of you in your group, then it seems like they people think it's fair game to just say terrible things about them.
So did you hear that with, like, at big family gatherings? Would you hear those kinds of jokes about other people?
No, I did not hear that. You know, I remember my oldest brother would get furious when somebody would tell a Polish joke, you know? And I just learned a lot about the Polish people. And I became very interested in some of the history of Polish scientists and things. And I took pride in being Polish in that. And so when I became a teacher, I would often speak with kids about, you know, not picking on other groups, not using slur words and stuff like that. And I would tell them that I learned a lot of things about Polish history, and I became very proud of being a Polish person, because the Polish people have done a lot of great things, you know, and in science and in all kind of things, you know, and even some of the American war heroes from early in the foundation of the country, a number of great Polish leaders that were fought for the American Revolution and stuff like that. So anyway, I can remember that was, what a realization that everybody gets picked on. You know, and I always thought it would be great. It would be nice if they did a stage play about that, but I'm not sure where you could stage a play like that. And then when Archie Bunker came on television, I loved it, because that was the first time, just about then, Archie Bunker and who was the other one? There was a black comedian who had a show on, and he was just as bad as Archie was. Mm-hmm. He was bad about the white people.
Yeah, his name just flew out of my head, but I know who.
Oh, yeah, and the Jefferson.
Oh, I thought you meant the older guy.
Red Fox.
Yeah, Red Fox.
Oh God, yeah, yeah. But anyway, I thought Archie Bunker was just, that show, All of the Family, that show was just wonderful for poking fun at the people who were racist or bigots and stuff like that. And it was so popular. And as a kid, I thought it was funny. I liked to watch it and everything. And then it was nice to learn that the guy who was the lead, who played Mr. Bunker, did other television shows.
Carol.
Carol O'Connor. He was really a nice guy. He wasn't like that at all. So seeing that actor being in a different show where he played In the Heat of the Night,
right?
I think was the show. He played a policeman in the South, and he wasn't racist. In fact, his girlfriend and then his wife was a woman of color in that show, and it was kind of, I thought that was kind of neat that he followed the one show where he was really a bad person, even though he was loved. The show was loved because it was so bad, I think.
Do you remember how old you were when you first saw the book of Italian, or the joke book?
I think I was probably 13 or 14. I think I might have been either in eighth grade or maybe ninth grade.
So it wasn't that you had never heard jokes like that about other groups besides Polish people, but yeah. It was the first time you thought about it a little bit more deeply and, you know, figured out that it was a thing that we could do something about.
And I was realizing that everybody does stuff like that. That not only the mean people are picking on other people,
right.
The nice people are picking on other people too, you know. And you know, I always thought it would be neat to try, you know, even a one-act play about neighbors. That would be interesting. But I think enough of that has been probably done on TV.
Exactly. You know, but one of the things that came across in my mother's stories, one of the things I learned from my mother's stories about being a WAC was how that broadened her horizons. So it wasn't that she had never had experiences with being with new people or in new groups,
right.
Or having to cope with people who thought very differently than she did, but it was the first time where she was on her own as an adult at age, you know, in her mid-20s,
right.
She had to figure out how to respond and make decisions about how she felt about those things and act accordingly and sometimes correct people or tell them that she didn't feel that way about things. And she made some really good friends, some of whom I met as an adult myself. So certainly, going far from home can give you a whole different perspective on the world.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Are we? I think we're out of time.
We're 57 minutes, past 57 minutes.
So it's time for me to say that this is Fanny Crawford.
And Stasz Ziolkowski.
Closing out the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, independent community radio broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland, but offering our listeners a window into the world of telling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. So thanks for listening, and stay tuned for...
Extremely smooth jazz.
Extremely smooth jazz.
You can see right through it.
Yeah.
So, anyway... I was told that there was two kinds of smooth jazz. It was the graphite and silicone.
Whoa. Oh,
interesting.
And, well, and that one was flat molecules and the other one was round molecules. So,
are you playing both kinds today?
You know, the problem is I can't tell the difference between the two, but my friend was telling me about it. It's just like...
Good story.
Anyway.
That's great.
So,
okay, guys.
All right, you guys are very good.
We're on next Monday?
Yeah, sure. With the, you know, 12th. If the floods don't come in and wipe us all out, or if I'm not transported, raptured to, meet the master and all that. So,
I wondered where you were planning on being transported to.
I'm not planning on
the rapture.
remember those things where the guy, you know, if you were, you kept asking these questions. Well, what happens if you were a pilot and you got raptured. And the rapture experts, at least the ones in California that I was talking to at the time, told me a serious tragedy.
Yeah.
But, you know, the price paid for failing to, get in the inside job there on Revelation.
It's a very small
before it was too late.
Very small group there, isn't it? 144,000?
It wasn't, about the size of four or five Noah's Arks, something like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
But,
All right, this is where I leave you.
Oh, by the way, before you go, did I tell you guys last week about the how the Gnostics did a runaround on the Old Testament because they could not see how it was ever possible that the God of the Old Testament had given birth to a child like Jesus?
Right, exactly. Because that guy was absolutely.
Anyway, all right. See you guys later.
That's a good one, John. Okay.